We're examining the life of a decorated Marine who was a leader in Sturgeon Bay. It's a conversation about the end of World War II and VJ Day, the Japanese surrender 75 years ago, here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The platoon's duties was to be deployed behind Japanese lines in the Pacific Theater and destroy targets without revealing their position. They were called the 40 Thieves, stealing everything from food, weapons, whatever they needed to accomplish their missions. Did a loved one tell you about fighting Japanese forces on islands in the Pacific? What did you learn? What do you want to know about the brutal and frantic combat? We're at 800-642-1234. Joseph Tofsky is co-author of 40 Thieves on Saipan, the elite Marine scout snipers in one of World War II's deadliest battles. Joe, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, good morning. Thank you for having me on today.
Good morning. Well, as you were growing up, what did your father tell you about his service? What did you know about your father's role in World War II?
Well, it was pretty apparent that he was a Marine in the Pacific because he was a retired colonel, and there'd be a lot of correspondence and old buddies would visit from time to time. But if he ever mentioned anything about the war, it was more about happy days, like being stationed in Iceland or aboard the USS Maryland, but never anything to do with actual combat in the Pacific.
Not actual combat, but you center this book on Saipan, this island. What happened there?
Well, Saipan was the first link in the chain of Japanese home islands that would lead to Tokyo. And it was very important asset to the Allies because of two of the finest airstrips were in the Saipan and the adjacent island of Tinian. The Ushi Airdrome on Tinian was where the Enola Gay took off of back in August of 1945.
And so as you started exploring what your father did there, what happened when you listened to his eulogy in 2011?
Well, that was very eye-opening because this gentleman from Sturgeon Bay got up to speak, and it wasn't odd that he would get up to speak, but he wasn't a family member. But he talked about the first time that he met Dad was at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, where Dad was there on a GI Bill and he stood out because he was old. And this guy was just a kid and he was in Naval ROTC. And he would go to meetings every day and there'd always be this Marine sergeant in his dress blues, a crew cut, and every inch a Marine, and it's very stoical. And if he had occasion to say somebody's name, he would just bark it out. But one day he sees this sergeant talking to my dad, and he's uncharacteristically happy, and they're laughing and joking. And this fellow thinks nothing of it until he sees it happen a couple more times. And then he finally goes up to the sergeant and says, "Excuse me, but how do you know Frank Tofsky?" And he said, "That man is Lieutenant Tofsky to you. And when you speak of him, do it with respect. He was our platoon leader on Saipan when a Japanese tank broke through our lines. And it kept advancing on us. The machine gun fire was intense, and we all thought we were goners. Then all of a sudden, out of the corner of my eye, the solitary figure runs out into the withering fire, shoots a bazooka, disables the tank, and kills the crew inside. That was the lieutenant. He saved my life that day. He saved the life of every man in the platoon. Every day is a bonus because of that man. So when you speak of him, do it with respect."
Mm. What a moving moment.
If a pin dropped on the carpet, you would have heard it. It was just very eye-opening and opened a segment of my father's life that, you know, of someone that I really never knew.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Joe Tofsky, who's the author of 40 Thieves on Saipan. It's a book about his father's experience in World War II. You can join in. Did you or a loved one serve in World War II? How should we honor the sacrifices of those who served? What interviews have you done with a loved one who's served in war? Join in 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Joe, you then set out on this journey, 9 years of piecing together what your father's life as a Marine might have looked like, doing these first-person interviews with his fellow Marines. You also looked at his footlocker and inside at the mementos. What did you find?
Well, a trove of, it was like opening a Christmas package. It was just a wonderful adventure going through letters that my father and mother saved. They met before World War II at a restaurant called Mike Lyman's in Los Angeles. So it's all of their correspondence, which was played out like, you know, their version of From Here to Eternity. But also in the footlocker was his platoon rosters for Guadalcanal, Tarawa, and Saipan. And since the eulogy mentioned Saipan, that's the roster that piqued my interest. And I started to notice names on it. And one of them was a fellow named William Knupple. And Bill Knupple was an old Marine Corps buddy that my dad would visit frequently when they'd winter together in Arizona. And I knew Bill. And that was my first cross-country trip, was to go to Arizona and see if he was the same William F. Knupple that was listed on the roster.
What did he tell you? What did you learn?
He was.
Yeah. I mean, this really set forth your oral histories. And what did that open up to you?
Well, as opposed to my dad, who spoke nothing about the war, Bill was just an encyclopedia and a font of information, and he would share stories about the platoon, the pig roast, big old Don Evans. He had photographs of all of the graves of the men who died on Saipan, and At first, I wasn't taking notes or recording or doing anything because I was just talking to Bill. But with the information that he provided, it piqued my interest. And when I got back home again, I started to search all of the names on the roster to find out which men from the platoon were still alive.
How many did you find who were alive?
There were five total. One of them was suffering from dementia, and I didn't want to bother him at all, because the last thing you want to do is open up the old wounds and bring back the memories that they've been trying to forget for their whole lives, really.
Yeah. You know, you write about how so many men rushed into marriage during the war, hurriedly getting married to their people they loved. And I'm wondering what these letters told you about those relationships back home.
Well, most men didn't want to get married. My father didn't want to get married before the war because he had advice from a World War I veteran that, you know, no one is the same when they come home from war. It changes a person. And, he didn't want to make that commitment to Roxy before the war, but my mom was a very forceful and beguiling woman, and she ended up winning out.
We have author Joe Tachofsky, who wrote about his father's Marine platoon in World War II and the battle on the island of Saipan in the summer of 1944, with heavy casualties, thousands of soldiers dead. How much do you know about the long, bloody conflict across the Pacific Front? Have you recorded a veteran's story about fighting in the Pacific Theater? What can you tell us? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show as we explore the untold story of the late Lieutenant Frank Tuhovsky of Sturgeon Bay. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A new book uncovers the story of brave undercover Marines in the Pacific Theater. They were known as the 40 Thieves, and the platoon's covert special operations contributed to victory over Japan in the end of World War II. Which war did you serve in? Were there casualties in your unit? What do you remember about war? Did you keep a personal diary? Have you shared it with a loved one? Be part of this, 800-642-1234. Joe Tuhovsky's new book about his father's platoon is called 40 Thieves on Saipan, and he stays with us for the hour. Joe, take us back to the summer of 1944. What was your father's unit's mission in Saipan?
The mission was, they were a unique platoon. There were only two such platoons that were deployed in the Pacific during World War II. One was on Tarawa, but their mission there was vastly different because it was a three-day, bloodbath. And there was no front lines to ever work behind. But on Saipan, there was about a month-long grinder of a battle, and their job was to go into enemy territory, scout positions, draw maps, make maps from memory, and create as much havoc as they could behind the enemy lines.
So they were disrupting enemy communications, destroying the things, the forces, and their ability to communicate?
Correct. In fact, I learned this from one of the surviving thieves in Georgia. Back then, all communication was done by running wire. They'd have to find all of these hidden wires around Saipan. And to disrupt them, they would just take a simple straight pin and put it through the telephone line and then clip the ends of it. If they severed the line, anyone could find that it had been cut and they could repair it. This way, they'd never know where the interruption was happening. I thought that was just, supremely brilliant and very resourceful of these, Marines who had to use almost anything and everything as a weapon, even straight pins.
Their nickname was the 40 Thieves. How did they get that?
Well, Marines of World War II in general were notorious thieves. They were the poorest equipped branch of service. In fact, when they went into Guadalcanal for the first time, they were issued rations, weapons, and uniforms that were left over from World War I. So they had to take on this seasoned Imperial Army who had been fighting in the Pacific for almost a decade with this bolt action Springfield rifle that had only six bullets in its cartridge. And it's just amazing what they were able to accomplish with so little. In fact, Dad writes that home at one point. He said, it's amazing, how much we do with so little. And back then they referred to thievery politely as acquiring by marine methods. So that was the line that they'd frequently use. But this platoon was the elite of the 6th Marine Regiment. They were handpicked from, hundreds of volunteers to do this very dangerous work.
And your father did the handpicking. He helped select the men.
Correct. He and his sergeant, Bill Knuppel, were the ones who did it. And Bill told me one of the prerequisites was that Dad would look for fellows with brig time. He wanted to see if the guys had been thrown in jail for brawling, being in a tight spot. And his justification was the guy that wins the fight goes to the brig, the loser goes to the infirmary. So the guy in the brig is the kind of guy he wanted.
Yeah, I think you're right. You're not a good Marine until you've been thrown in the brig once or twice.
Correct.
Joe Tuhovsky is author of 40 Thieves on Saipan. It's a book about his father's experience in World War II in the Pacific Theater. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Brian is with us in Superior. Hi, Brian. What would you like to add?
Well, my Uncle Harold Miner was in the Navy in World War II, and he had a little room in his house dedicated to all his stuff. And my family, my wife and I and our kids, would stop by in St. Cloud and visit him whenever we went through town. And one time, about 20 years ago, we were talking about the war for some reason, which he rarely did, but he said his small aircraft carrier, the USS Kaupins, was anchored in the harbor at the end of the war when the Japanese were signing the surrender papers on the Missouri. So his ship was like a mile away, right next to it. He told me that all the other ships, the Navy didn't really trust the Japanese yet, and they were out in the ocean outside the harbor, but his was right there. And after the surrender, he said his ship, the Kaupins, was given liberty that day, and they got to go into Tokyo, one of the first people ever. So then he's telling us this story, which he had never told me. I'm like 40 years old at the time. And he gets up, goes across his living room, and he goes onto the mantel and takes out these two Japanese Oriental fans. And he goes, these two fans are what I picked up in Tokyo today, on that day.
On that day.
And then he gave them to my family, and that was something. That was very moving.
Oh, wow. Brian, thank you for sharing that. Yeah. Joe, what would you say to that story?
Well, they had good reason to be wary of the Japanese surrender. They're a very tenacious and warrior people in those days. And in fact, the fighting in the Philippines lasted for, I think, weeks after the Japanese officially surrendered. And the famous sole survivor that is mimicked on Gilligan's Island episodes from time to time, that was an actual Japanese soldier who was on Tinian who didn't surrender until sometime in the 1950s.
What kind of equipment did your father carry in this mission?
Well, it would be the standard equipment, but they were also carried an array of knives and things that were used for silent killing techniques. This was things that I learned from not only Bill Knuppel in Montana, but Bob Smots in Georgia and Marvin Strombo in Missoula and Roscoe Mullins in West Virginia. But they had an array of knives. And also strangulation gear, piano wire on two pieces of wood. And one of the fellows in the platoon was named Bill Emmerich, and he was a club fighter out of Chicago. And he referred to that as a mafia necktie.
You also have some illustrations of what these men were looking at for silent killings and how to do it. And it's just, it is really hard to look at. It's, and I found it really difficult to even look at this section of the book. How was that for you in finding this memorabilia?
It's, you know, very eye-opening, evidently, that this was what these men had to live through. Their battle was much more up close and personal than laying down a barrage or being in a line company. And as you said, it was a very gruesome thing to look at. But the best comment we had about the book, because I wanted to tell their story, to have it be in their words as much as possible. A reader from Montana said it neither sugarcoats nor glorifies. And I thought that was the best way to describe it and to put it into perspective for people as to what these men actually had to go through and then have to come home and pretend like nothing happened.
What did they tell you about their nightmares?
Well, it was something that was always, I was reticent to ask them too many questions, but I had to, because it did open up these old wounds and trigger nightmares. And one of the fellow's nightmares is what he lived through when he saw his best buddy get killed on a mission in Saipan. And then he goes chasing the Japanese through this tall elephant grass, and he finally catches them, and they're in hand-to-hand combat, and that's when he wakes up. In fact, his wife, Alma, who's still with us in Georgia, Bob passed away a year ago, took me aside after one of my first visits and said, you know, it's so great that you're here and talking to Bob because he doesn't have anyone to talk to about this. And then she confided in me that as a bride at 19 years old, when Bob came home from the war, they were married right away. They'd been sweethearts since they were 14. They got married at they met at an Ollis Chalmers tractor show in Oklahoma. but she confided in me that, you know, she would periodically wake up at night to find Bob choking her because he was having one of his nightmares and he thought she was a Japanese soldier. She was able to discover the early warning signs to him having his nightmare. But still, the scars of those two brief years live with these men throughout their lives.
We're talking with author Joe Tachofsky on a mission to understand his father's platoon and actions fighting Japanese forces. We'll pick this up with Joe after a news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. The Battle of Saipan was considered one of the bloodiest World War II battles. We're learning about the late Lieutenant Frank Tachofsky of Sturgeon Bay, his Special Operations Platoon, and the Marines who contributed to the Japanese surrender in 1945. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Marine Marvin Strombo died in June. Remarkable story. He's one of the primary sources for this book. Here he reflects on taking a Japanese good luck flag from the body of a fallen soldier.
Taking the flag kind of bothered me because it's so special, I think. And it's like it part of him. He had it tucked into his coat, and I barely saw it. And I just about didn't take it, but then I thought, at least if I take it, it'd be a chance I can get it back.
And he did. Strombo traveled to a remote village in Japan at age 93 to return that flag in person. What has a veteran told you about war? 800-642-1234. Joe Tachofsky's book is called 40 Thieves on Saipan, and he stays with us for the hour. Joe, remarkable story there. Marvin Strombo returning to Japan all those decades later. Why did he do that?
It was a promise that he made to this dead Japanese captain. I don't know what attracted Marvin to walk out into this field of dead Japanese soldiers, probably from a mortar strike, he thought. But there was something about him that just drew Marvin's attention, and he made a promise to that corpse that he would return the flag someday. And when he did, it was quite a moving ceremony because the captain's younger brother accepted the flag. And the first thing that he did was he took it to his face and inhaled deeply and said, "You've taken good care of my brother."
Oh, wow. How did that help Strombo in traveling there and in helping him see? I mean, he too talked about the nightmares and how everybody had them. Was this a healing time for him in his late 90s?
It was a promise that he made, and these were a whole group of noble men who were true to their word, and it was something that he felt compelled to do, and fortunately, you know, he was able to do it, and that brought him great peace to know that that part of the puzzle. It'd be like, returning a body to a family. It was almost like they were bringing the captain's soul back to the family. It meant that much to them, and Marvin was aware of that. That's what these good luck flags were. They were, you know, sacred relics, really, to each individual Japanese soldier, because everyone from their hometown would sign a rising sun flag with well wishes for them to carry into battle with them. And, you know, for most Marines, they were great souvenirs because they were light and, you know, guys in the Army Air Corps or, you know, rear echelon troops would pay big money for a flag. And what made it so easy for them to find the family was that, you know, since Marvin had the flag, he knew where he got it. And it was much easier to track down the family because he didn't buy the flag from somebody. He knew where it came from.
One of the 40 thieves had a keen sense of smell and could smell if Japanese forces were nearby. Can you tell us a little bit more there about what that was about?
Sure. That's my little fellow from Georgia, Bob Smots. He passed away a year ago in this past June. And he said that it was nothing foul, but just very distinctive because of their predominantly rice diet, that when they would sweat it out, it had a very distinctive odor that he could track. It was just one of those things that he just had a knack for. He grew up on the Osage Indian Reservation in Oklahoma, and he was part Native American. And so he had wonderful tracking skills. He told me once that he was, you know, learned how to track, hunt, and shoot by the time he was old enough to hold a rifle.
You write that there was no room for bigotry in this platoon, that a scout sniper's survival depended on the man next to him, regardless of race or religion. Did these men talk to you about race?
Not really. It didn't matter to the men in the Corps. If you did your job, that was what was the most important. In fact, an article that was recently written in DC magazine, you know, spoke of how the Marine Corps is a good role model for working together. In fact, one of the mantras of the platoon was "Working together, we make each other better." And that's just something that my father firmly believed in, that it didn't matter anybody's, you know, race or religion. He was quite, you know, for 1930s and 40s, that was very forward thinking at the time.
Your father was awarded a Bronze Star for his efforts in the battle. What did he do to earn this?
Well, you know, my father was a very humble fellow, and he always considered that he was never deserving of any award of valor, whether it was the Silver Star on Tarawa or the Bronze Star on Saipan. He always maintained that he didn't do anything that any other Marine wouldn't have done.
Was that feeling pretty universal among his colleagues, that this humility, that, you know, he was just doing his job, was that pervasive?
It certainly was. In fact, not to keep on bringing him up, but Bob Smuts from Georgia said that after the battle, this platoon was given something like 10 different awards of valor to be distributed among members of the platoon. And they all took a vote and decided that none of the surviving members wanted an award, that it should be given to those who had died or had been wounded, because they felt it would probably mean more to the families left behind.
What did the numbers look like? How many people in your father's unit were killed?
There were five. One of them was actually not a Marine. One of the fellows in the platoon was a gregarious, larger-than-life character whose name was Don Evans, and he was a squad leader from Kansas City. And before shipping out from Hawaii, where they were training, they had one last leave in Honolulu, and he went to visit these two Army buddies of his that were stationed at Schofield Barracks. Their names were Tommy Arello and Norman Dooley. And Bill Knuppel was with Don Evans, so this story comes directly from Bill Knuppel, and he tells how they spent the night drinking. And at the end of the night, they were so plotched, Don and Bill thought it would be a good idea for these two Army guys to go AWOL and join them for the invasion of Saipan, And the Army guys were just plotched up enough to do it. And in an ambush that was on June 22nd in 1944, both Don Evans and Tom Morello were killed, as well as another member of the platoon and many more wounded.
Paul Lewis is a pseudonym for a member of the platoon who fellow thieves were reluctant to identify. What was that situation?
Well, this is, they referred to it back in the day as being shell-shocked. And it was something that was so, I wouldn't say prevalent, but you didn't want it to be you. And you certainly felt sorry for the guys that couldn't take it anymore, that finally broke down because of the sounds and sights and horrors of war. And they would not name this fellow who had, you know, who became shell-shocked, but they told stories of him and how he acted and how, you know, some guys felt sorry for him, a few others more hardened, you know, didn't like it. But I just had to give him a name, and I thought that story was, you know, a riveting part of telling their story. So we just gave him the pseudonym of Paul Lewis.
We're talking with author Joe Tachofsky, who wrote a book about the experience of his father, Frank, in World War II. Frank Tachofsky went on to become the mayor of Sturgeon Bay. You can join in with your questions and your memories, 800-642-1234. Joe, you recreated a letter sent to one of Bill Knuppel's friends who had recently been killed. Can you tell us about how reading this letter and putting it together, you were able to do that as a writer and author?
I believe you're talking about the letter that Bill Emmerich wrote Knuppel?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Okay. Yeah. Bill, Wild Bill, he's the mafia necktie guy. He was sort of had his, got hit by a dum-dum bullet, and that's where the Japanese would cut off the tip of a bullet, and it would enter in a single shot, but then inside the body it would explode and exit sort of like a shotgun blast. And fortunately, he survived. So recreating the letter is just basically, you know, Bill told me that Emmerich wrote back and then told me what was in the letter, and then using some language that I acquired from, you know, through Knuppel's diary that he provided to me, as well as letters written by Don Evans, I could sort of created a language for that was unique to Wild Bill Emmerich, you know, for the book. You know, part of it was, you know, the trouble was trying to put flesh on the bones of these stories and make it believable and make a develop a language and a dialogue from it. And what I found very helpful for that was during all of my trips, you know, from Wisconsin to Arizona, Montana, Georgia, West Virginia, I would listen to a lot of old time radio just to hear how people spoke in the 1940s, you know, whether it was Suspense or the CBS radio network or, you know, other suspense stories of the day.
Yeah, let's pause there with author Joe Tachofsky of Sturgeon Bay, and we will be back in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with Joe Tachofsky. His book is called 40 Thieves on Saipan. After his father's death in 2011, he went on a journey to reconstruct what his father had endured in combat with personal interviews, oral histories of veterans in his platoon. And he gives us a fuller picture of the elite Marine team on the island of Saipan fighting a relentless enemy who would not surrender and being behind enemy lines. Let's bring in Dan now from La Crosse. Hi, Dan. What is your story?
Hi. I grew up, my next door neighbor that I grew up next to, you know, all my life, he was a career Navy man. He was in the Navy even before the war, and he was over in the Far East. It was back when it was the Asiatic fleet and everything. And he, you know, he showed me a cruise book he had, and the captain of his ship was Chester Nimitz, who went on to bigger bigger things. Anyway, he said, early in the war, he was on the USS Vincennes. He says, and we were in San Francisco Harbor, and we were, you know, we were waiting for orders to move out. And next to us was a carrier, he said, and they had these planes on the deck, and they were bigger planes. You could tell they were bigger planes, and they had covers over them. And they wondered, well, what the heck's, what's going on with them? And they thought, well, we're probably going to escort them to Hawaii and drop these planes off. Well, they got out to sea, and they took off. Well, then they announced, they said, we're going to go and bomb Tokyo. So he was, what it was Doolittle's raid. And they went, and he was in on that. They were an escort ship for them. And they bombed, the history of his Doolittle's raid, and they bombed Tokyo. Well, later on, he said they were down in Guadalcanal. They were fighting down in the Solomons, which was a real dogfight on land, sea, and air. I think it went on about 6 months, the fighting the Japanese down there, and it was real tough fighting. He says, and one night, he says he was in on the, he called it the Second Battle of Savo Island. And that's the night that I think the U.S. Navy lost 3 cruisers, and I think the Australians lost one. And I think that's the same battle where I think the Juno was down there too, and that's where the Sullivan brothers all got killed. And he said, we got sunk, and you know, he said, we were in the water. And this, and about the time he's telling me this was when Jaws came out, about, you know, the shark movie.
Sure. Yeah.
And I said, well, were you guys worried about sharks? Did you think about that? And he says, huh. He says, you know, we didn't even think about that. He says, the only thing we had on our minds was we wanted to get on another ship and get another crack at the Japs, he said.
Oh, goodness. Wow. Dan, thank you for bringing that. I want to allow Joe for you to respond to that story.
Well, one of the fellows from the platoon, Richard Nall, who was in from St. Louis, he was in one of those battles around Guadalcanal aboard the USS Hornet. And that was damaged as well. And he was thrown into the sea as well and had one of those, you know, stories of survival where he dragged his injured buddy into the lifeboat and he stayed outside because there was no room for him. Mm-hmm. And his buddy ended up dying, you know, when they got back to the ship, but he survived and became a member of the 40 Thieves. But and another fellow, Roscoe Mullins, had a buddy who was aboard the Indianapolis and survived that tragedy only to die in a coal mine disaster when he returned home in West Virginia.
Wow. Dan, thank you. Bringing in now Ray in Manitowoc. Hi, Ray.
Hey, good morning. I just wanted to give you a shout-out, 70-year-old guy here, and spot on about the World War II generation staying very, very quiet. My father served in the Army over in Europe, all the way from Africa through Sicily, Italy, France to Germany. I also had an uncle that served in the Pacific. Neither one of these guys would talk at all. However, they were both huge exercises on patience. They were completely and totally unflappable. I guess basically that whole generation was pretty much like that. And my generation's got to say, you know, thank you very much for everything you did. You know,
Ray,
I mean, anything I did afterwards pales by comparison.
Ray, thank you. Joe, why do you think your father never spoke about his war experiences?
Well, as I think Roscoe Mullins said, one of the thieves from West Virginia, killing is nothing to brag about.
That's really powerful.
Yeah, these men were just so noble in what they did. In fact, you know, it's so funny that all of them would never shed a tear when they'd talk about their buddies who had died. But on Saipan, there was a mass Japanese suicide at the end where civilians were throwing themselves off the cliffs of Marpe Point instead of surrendering to the Americans. Thousands of civilians, mothers were throwing babies into the sea and then following them. They never shed a tear over talking about a friend who had died, but they all broke down when talking about Marpe Point.
Your father had bouts of malaria. What was his health like through this service?
He, well, and after malaria, he had dengue fever on Saipan, which is a different type of malaria. They call it breakbone fever, because it feels like all of your bones are being broken. And throughout all of this battle, he basically had to write home to Roxy every day, because communication being what it was, it might take 2 weeks to a month for family back home to receive letters. And so he'd have to write every day, because if there were a letterless day, that might, you know, either instill a bit of hope that he might be on his way home, or that something terrible had happened. And one of the letters that he's writing, he's wishing her a happy anniversary, but he's got dengue fever and it's delirious and it's not their anniversary.
Oh.
There were so many diseases and that these fellows had to battle through. Dysentery was the worst. And that was pretty much associated with Tarawa because of I think there were about 10,000 dead bodies on Tarawa, which was basically the size of Central Park in New York.
Oh. Why do you think that generation was better equipped, better able to act collectively than perhaps we are today?
Well, they pretty much grew up in the Great Depression, where you had to be improvisational with your survival skills, and you learned to cooperate and adapt and improvise, you know, much more so than, you know, any generation since, when, you know, my God, if you don't have an internet connection for, you know, 2 minutes, you're in a lather over it.
Do you feel closure in your father's story and his contributions in Sturgeon Bay?
I don't know if closure would be the right word, because, you know, his life will never be closed to me. And, but it does bring a greater level of respect and reverence. Certainly you love your father because he's your dad, but to know what he went through and how he was able to survive and prosper, you know, coming back home, that is the amazing part, because many of these people weren't as lucky. Wild Bill Emmerich, for example, drank himself to death by the time he was 40 years old. That happened to another fellow in the platoon. Many of these men, you know, through my research, I could see that they had strings of failed marriages and estranged children. So to come back home and be able to cobble together a semblance of normalcy was, you know, the most amazing thing that, you know, I personally am thankful for.
Joe, thank you for joining us and sharing this story.
Well, thank you for having me on today. It's been a pleasure.
Joe Tachofsky, author of 40 Thieves on Saipan, a book about his father's experience in World War II. Just ahead, it is 1A with certification deadlines coming up in several key states. Many questions loom. When will the vote in key states be certified? What will happen next? If it's not, 1A checks in. That is next. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.